Thursday Night Football with John Giles.
Johnny Giles is a national treasure. When he speaks, I mean, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. When he's on the show, I was in the car the other day. I parked the car and I sprinted into the house and turned on the radio. I love listening to him. I love Johnny Giles.
John Giles, every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app. The OTB Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Let's go to Andy Mitten, who is in Germany. Andy, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. I wish that I would have had a little bit more sleep, but I'd agreed to speak to you, and I'm up and I'm ready to speak to you.
Well, thanks very much.
And all's good.
So a late night then, Andy? Was that the...
Yeah, it was a late night. Not that I was out indulging. The game kicked off at 9 p.m. local time. There was extra time on top of that. So it was well after midnight by the time I left the stadium in Cologne. It took me 40 minutes to get a tram back into Cologne and then another hour on to Dusseldorf, which is fine, but I woke up at 5 o'clock yesterday morning and I'd not slept so well the night before. And I'm not 21 anymore, but I'm okay. I'm pleased that Manchester United are through to the semi-finals of the Europa League. It was a hard slog against Copenhagen. They were pretty much exactly how their manager, Stanley Stolbakken, said they would be. I spoke to him for 45 minutes on Friday. He's a very interesting man. He managed briefly in Wolves and in Cologne, but he's been in charge of Copenhagen for 14 years, and his team are very well organised. They don't concede many goals at all. It was their 17th European game of the season, and they knocked Celtic out, among other clubs, and they were very difficult to break down. It wasn't a vintage Manchester United performance, especially at the start, but Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's team did improve against his compatriots' side. And Bruno Fernandes, again, he scored. It was United's 21st penalty of the season. And it's enough to put United through to a tie on Sunday, again in Cologne. So I'll be repeating that trip again and again and again. And that will be against either Wolves, who Manchester United keep drawing. I think that'll be the sixth game this season, if it's Wolves. But Wolves have got to overcome Sevilla. Sevilla are the fourth best team in Spain. Really strong in this competition. They've got a better record in the Europa League than any other team. So I quite enjoy this competition. I think it's one that Manchester United should be winning or intending to win. But it's going to be difficult. And if it is to be Sevilla, United should be vengeful there, because Sevilla knocked the team out of the 2008 Champions League, which was one of the reasons why Jose Mourinho's stock really began to slip at Old Trafford.
A couple of things. The difficulties around travel that you're experiencing and all that kind of stuff, and the weirdness of the whole scenario. Here we are in high summer in Germany and the temperatures are high. It's just, there's just an oddness to everything, notwithstanding the fact that the games are behind closed doors. Is that having any impact on the quality of the football that we're seeing, do you think?
I don't think it helps. The temperature last night was 31 and it was very humid. So I was seeing people complain about the performance on social media during the game. And I was thinking, well, I'm here and it's pretty uncomfortable in the stands. So it's not going to be any better on the pitch. I've been in that stadium one time before when Cologne beat Arsenal in 2017. And it was rocking. German stadiums are very atmospheric. They've all been built closer to the pitches after the 2006 World Cup, because before that, a lot of the German stadiums had been built in the 70s for the 74 World Cup, and they had running tracks. Now they've got standing terraces, and it's a joy to watch football in them when there's fans. When there's no fans, it's completely odd. And I spoke to Manchester United and FC Copenhagen fans in Cologne, down by the Rhine, before the game. They travelled over. Of course, there's a social aspect to it. They're having a few drinks with the friends and they knew they were not going to get into the game. And that just fills me with sadness when I meet people like that, because I know who they are. I've seen them going to games for decades. They're hardcore supporters. And they have a song at United, "If the Reds Should Play in Rome or Mandalay, We'll Be There." And they were there. and they were having a good time, there's no doubt about it, but it's still really sad, and I'd like fans to be back. I think everybody would, as soon as possible. And I was speaking to a director of a Bundesliga club before the game, someone who I know from this part of the world, and he was saying, we're trying to get fans in October, but it's frustrating, and it will be the politicians that decide the numbers, and we need 15,000 to get through into our club, and it's not looking like we're going to be allowed to get that number through. So it's a longer slog than we first thought in terms of getting fans back. I thought this would be a two-month blip, and it doesn't look like being that. But United will carry on playing, and if United can win the Europa League, I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer can say, this has been a successful season. We've finished third, and I've won a competition, and I've reached another two domestic semi-finals as well. I'm not saying it's the treble season, but it's progress.
The performance actually wasn't that bad. It's just that they came up against an inspired goalkeeping performance. I think I saw a stat before the end of normal time that this is the second time this year that they've had 18 shots and not actually managed to score. Was Burnley the last time? Am I right about that? But whatever it was like an outrageously imbalanced performance in terms of shots. And at some point, this team is good enough that they will score goals from that.
Yeah, I thought that Copenhagen actually had the better chances early on, and a better team would have punished Manchester United. And you conceded the difference between playing against Bayern Munich or FC Copenhagen. But as I said right at the start, Copenhagen are impressive. Their results are impressive. They're not playing in one of the top five leagues. And Solbakken explained to me in great detail on Friday, their aims each year are to reach the group stage of the Europa League, and they've now gone past that, to win the Danish league. They have been doing that. They didn't do it this year. And to identify, develop and sell players to teams in richer leagues. And it's a very successful business model, which they're doing with someone who's pretty much like the Sir Alex Ferguson of Scandinavia. They play a zonal defensive system, and it was effective. There were not spaces in it, even for United's rapid attackers. And it was difficult out there. But United did get stronger, as you say, especially towards the end. Bruno Fernandes was having a lot of chances. I thought Juan Mata was a very good substitution when he came on. And they were also looking a bit leggy. And part of me can't work that out, because there's been this big break for the lockdown, and yet players like Fernandes are looking a lot more tired in recent weeks. I suppose it's down to the sheer number of matches, and there's going to be two more matches this week, and maybe two, maybe one, and they're going to be difficult. But I'm watching United at the moment, and I'm thinking there's room for encouragement here, there's room for optimism here, but you can also see why the club are trying to get Jadon Sancho to take United towards the level that they should be at, because it's one thing struggling to overcome a stubborn Copenhagen team. If United are really going to be where they need to be, they're going to be after doing that against teams like Bayern Munich and PSG.
What else are they missing, Andy, apart from Jadon Sancho? Because they obviously created loads of chances last night, so it's not just Sancho's not going to be, you know, as a Man United fan, you hope that he has the same impact as the last big signing they had. But what else in terms of first teamers do you think they could spend money on and somebody would improve the team straight away?
I think there'll be improvement without buying anyone, although Ole Gunnar told me he wants two or three players to compete for the title. So if you look at the fullbacks, for example, I think defensively they're pretty fine, but going forward there's not enough crosses, there's not enough assists. But Brandon Williams is only 18 years old. Mason Greenwood on the right, he's 18 as well. With age comes consistency, but you can't just switch it on and expect a teenager to be performing every week, which is why A, Mata came on, and B, why United are interested in Sancho. Maybe in central midfield, I was a little bit surprised that Matic didn't start. Pogba improved in the second half, but looked a little bit off it. They all did at the start of the game. And the defence has been good this year. Statistically, it's been good. I think the number of goals being conceded in the league, it's in the same league as Manchester City and Liverpool, who are miles ahead in terms of points. But I don't think anybody looks at central defence and says this is Nemanja Vidic and Rio Ferdinand, or Steve Bruce and Gary Pallister all over again. So I think there's room for improvement. The goalkeeper, David De Gea, has not had a good season. You can't pretend otherwise, but just more consistency. But that has come since January, since that Burnley game that you spoke about. But if you look at the points average since then, it's still not quite good enough for a team that's going to be winning the league in a normal season. It's still a team that's second or third. So more options for Solskjaer. Some of those players looked dead on the feet last night. And he has scouted and identified and bought well, but he needs more from the players as well. Dan James started well, but faded throughout the season. Cut him a bit of slack because it was his first season. Wan-Bissaka's been good defensively, but he's young. The team's young. It's the youngest team in the Premier League. So I think United will benefit from more games together, more confidence together. Keeping Pogba, because everyone thought he was going to go. Fernandes has been an excellent signing, and start afresh next season and start a lot better than they did last season.
Do you think De Gea will be there next season?
Yeah, I do. I'm not going to go to court and prove that, but I do. I can't see how anyone can afford his wages, especially when he's been less than convincing this season. And I know very well what his stock is in Spain, and it's nothing like it was in 2015 when he was about to go to Real Madrid. He hasn't performed well for the Spanish national team, but he needs to cut back on the mistakes. What I don't know is what Dean Henderson's role is going to be, because he's had an excellent season at Sheffield United. Or Sergio Romero, he's been very good in the Europa League, and it wasn't his busiest night against FC Copenhagen, but it was another clean sheet for him, and I don't think anybody would be too worried if he starts in the semi-final on Sunday. And as Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said, the goalkeeping situation is not one that troubles him too much in terms of the goalkeepers he's got to choose from. But De Gea has got to cut out those high-profile mistakes, which have been magnified. It's always going to happen at Manchester United, and have cost the team this season.
Andy, can I just ask about, you mentioned Juan Mata there, and obviously he came off the bench last night, was lively. I think someone had mentioned that he had something like 19 Premier League appearances this year. He didn't score. 32 now, so kind of getting on a bit. And obviously if United bring in new talent, that's going to squeeze his position out of the team even further. But ESPN had stats as well last week saying he was the highest paid sub in the Premier League. So I think Mesut Ozil was only fifth on the list. But what's his role in the United team? Should they strengthen?
Well, I don't think them stats are entirely fair towards Juan Mata, because he only started 8 Premier League games. Nobody started more games in the Europa League than Juan Mata. And you might say that the Europa League is where his level is for United this season. When he signed last June, I can remember tweeting that I thought it was a good thing that he'd signed, because I knew that there was going to be players leaving the club. And he's a really good person. I think everybody knows that. Not that you necessarily just want someone in the dressing room because he's a really good person, but he definitely does help. And he does have his moments, and he does have his uses, and he proved that last night. It was a very effective substitution. And when he started games, I remember Southampton in August, he was the best player in the first half. He was finding those pockets of spaces. He was driving forward. But he's not going to be as influential as Bruno Fernandes could be. It was a great substitution in Cologne when he came on, and I'm really pleased for him. And he does earn a lot of money, but I still think on balance it was the right thing to keep him. I think he started 21 games overall, and as long as he's supplying the players to score the goals, the younger lads around him. But I'm not going to be kidding and say this is Manchester United's future. I think the reasons for keeping him, and I was a little bit surprised that he stayed, because I didn't know whether he wanted to be playing week in, week out, but he's got a good connection at the club, and maybe there weren't enough people like Mata or of Mata standing in the dressing room this season. So I'm glad that he stayed. But you can hear buts in my voice.
Yeah,
this isn't Manchester United's future, no way about it. But I've got a little bit of sympathy with Juan as well, because he's played at the club at the wrong time. If he would have come in a decade earlier, he would have won trophies. And David De Gea always says to him, "You should have seen what this city was like when we won the league in 2013. And that was always been Juan Mata's motivation to win the league. And it's probably not going to happen for him, which is a shame. But he's a great human. He really is. And football, it's a great sport, but it's not always a great industry. And truly, and I know him, I think he's a great human being.
You get the impression that people like him around the club are hugely important for the culture that Solskjaer is trying to... And we talk about culture all the time. And ultimately, if a team is winning, a load of the stuff that counts as culture ends up being just looked after because competition happens on the pitch. Naturally, everybody wants to be part of the winning team. But when a team isn't winning, like it wasn't all the time when Solskjaer took over and had his sticky patch, that's when it really requires people in the dressing room to be calm and have some experience, to be good people and to kind of just bring everybody in line. And if you don't have people who are doing that, like we've just been talking about, then maybe you're in trouble. And I guess that's the other thing that has to happen this summer as well. There's been a slow, steady clearing out of players just to make sure that you weren't going to be any bad influence or part of the first team or your mistakes weren't going to be tolerated anymore. Is there a fringe of those players who we could expect to see moved on quietly this summer?
Yes, although is it ever quiet with Manchester United? Your first point is absolutely right. The start of this season was dreadful. It was nowhere near good enough. There cannot be a repeat of that. I'm sick of hearing myself saying it, but 4 wins in the first 14 league games up to the start of December was woeful. And I put that to the manager and he admits that, and he wouldn't get away with that next season. It has to be much, much better. And you can talk about fine lines. You can talk about what you want. People will still judge you by results. I think Solskjaer will continue his process and moving on the players, some of them who earn, I was going to say extortionate, and I suppose it is to normal people, amounts of money for not contributing so much to United. But he's actually done it quite effectively. If you look at the players he didn't want, he moved them on. United got very good money for Romelu Lukaku. They've moved Alexis Sanchez on, and that was a disastrous signing, but he has gone. And his money is now off the wage bill. And I think there's other players there. We know who they are. The team selections have been clear. If someone comes in for Marcus Rojo, who's on loan, or Phil Jones, or Jesse Lingard, then I think United would listen to offers. The problem is these people earn too much money. And because they've not been doing brilliantly well, that creates a lack of demand for them. But I still think Jesse Lingard is a Premier League player. I think he's not actually done badly when he's come on as substitute in the last couple of weeks either. But again, he's not another one who's Manchester United's future. I'd be stunned if he was. And United have been pretty strict in the contract negotiations as well, because there was a situation a year ago where there's the second highest wage bill in world football, and United were nowhere near the second best team in world football. They were overpaying, and agents knew that. So they let players go like Ander Herrera, who they felt were being totally unrealistic in their demands for what they wanted to stay at the club. And of course they're going to pay well. If Jadon Sancho comes in, of course he's going to be played incredibly well. But what you're not going to see is this shattering of the wage structure, which caused so many problems with Alexis Sanchez, because players were looking at him and thinking, he earns 2, 3, 4, 5 times what I'm earning, and he's not even playing. And some can turn a blind eye to it, but for others, it just causes an issue in the dressing room. And Solskjaer wants a good team spirit, and he's adamant that he's getting that. And I think results are showing that there has been an improvement as well.
That's the long term. That's the original sin of the last half decade, is paying Alexis Sanchez that money, because it doesn't just impact the top, it impacts the bottom players. So everybody who suddenly is now getting their first contract, or their second contract, more importantly, the one where they've proven that they're actually capable of being a bit part player, are suddenly getting 20 to 40 grand a week more than they would be at any of the other Premier League teams, because the top guy's getting paid the most. And the agent walks in and has got a very easy job and saying, that's what you're paying Alexis Sanchez. That's what it says in the paper, and we know it's true. So you've got to give my guy at least 1/5 of that. And it's like, oh no, what have we done? And it's weird that it's fallen to Solskjaer to fix this, because actually it's Woodward's fault. And it's that side of the business's responsibility to fix it. While Solskjaer has had this weird playing squad that, you know, he has to come in and put some discipline on and at the same time deal with what's going on with Pogba and the crisis of confidence that his goalkeeper has. When you take all that together, I think it's fair to say that he's done a very good job to make the comeback that he's made from four wins in the opening 14 games. Which does bring me nicely around to Woodward and the suggestion that the Sancho deal is now in a negotiation phase where ultimately I think this is one of those deals where they want the player, he's the right age profile, he's definitely got the quality that they need. There can't be that much in terms of difference between the fee. Like, this is one of those deals where I would actually say pay the money, get him in, sort it out now, as opposed to paying Alexis Sanchez whatever he wants because he's free.
Yeah, you might say that, but it's not your money. And Dortmund won 120 million euros. And this isn't off the back of a good exchange rate either against the pound. I absolutely agree that Sancho is a top, top class player. What am I basing that on? Because I'm not watching it every week. Well, I spoke to somebody who's won the Bundesliga the other day and who knows far more about Sancho than I does. And I just asked him to run through three or four players. And Sancho just came out in great detail on top of them. Although he did say he felt he was better last season than this season. I think there hasn't been an agreement yet. The transfer talk gets crazy. I sense that some Manchester United fans are more into transfers and the signing of players than the actual games themselves. I even think that some, you could actually get rid of the games and just sign players. And that's your story. That's where your interest comes from. And it gets more ridiculous every year. I think United just took the sting out of the tail last week when they said, look, we haven't got an agreement. We haven't agreed personal terms with him. Clearly, he's the number one target. I do think that he wants to join Manchester United. He wants to come back to England. But Dortmund are not under huge pressure to sell either. But United feel that football's economics have changed with Corona. The market's certainly not more inflated than it was. And feel that Dortmund may be still thinking it's 2017, 18, 19 when they got such huge amounts for Ousmane Dembele to Barcelona, who's been pretty mixed actually. And I think it's just a negotiation process. And when Dortmund say our deadline is the 10th of August, that's arbitrary. That's not the transfer deadline. This transfer deadline is in October. I really hope this doesn't go on until October.
It will kill us if it does.
Mate, you've not got people coming up to your mum saying in the street when she's doing a shopping, saying, what's going on with Sancho? Can you ask your Andy? Can you ring your Andy now and find out what's going on with Sancho? And you end up stepping back from it because it just gets crazy, gets absolutely crazy. And as I said, some people are totally obsessed by these transfers. And when and if, and I think he probably will, sign, they just move on to the next target straight away. It's like in pursuit of the next one. And these people get like one game before they're being judged. Oh, I knew we shouldn't have got him. And a lot of them are young supporters and they're very excited at the prospect of someone like Sancho coming in. And I totally get that. And he is needed. And he is versatile. And he is fast. And he's tricky to watch. And he's hugely skillful. And I think he could be a world-class player. I think he's potentially that good. But there's another factor in here because there's been quite a lot of criticism in Germany against Bayern Munich's dominance. And Bayern Munich have started to hit back from that, saying, we actually want competition. Who are our biggest rivals? Borussia Dortmund. They're a selling club. We want them to be stronger. They're a selling club. I mean, Dortmund don't really need to sell. They've got enough money now. They don't need to sell. They're becoming like a Premier League club. And I think that they've been stung a little bit by Uwe Hoeneß's comments from Bayern Munich, saying, you know, you can't be a true competitor to us when you're selling your best players all the time. Because if Dortmund had kept Dembele and do keep Sancho and had kept Lewandowski, and there's loads more, Dortmund have sold so many great, great players, they would have won the league. Bayern wouldn't have won it 8 seasons in succession. So Dortmund are not where they were in 2005, where they were about to go under. They needed to raise capital through shares. they were haggling over a couple of hundred thousand when they took Steven Pienaar from Ajax. They're much, much stronger now. But please, just get it sorted out one way or another. But I do see where United are coming from by not saying we're paying 120, because we've had our pants pulled down too many times recently because people know that we've got money. And United are not any richer because of Corona. United were burning through £25 million per month during the lockdown. And they're in a much stronger position than most clubs. But the finances have changed. They definitely have.
So you think it will get done, but it actually could be another month, another 2 months?
I don't know. I wish I did know. I know that there's not been an agreement so far. And when I've seen stories last week about personal terms have been agreed, as a journalist, I tried to find out the answer to that question. And I just got back, no, they haven't. They haven't. So what was happening was Dortmund were using the German media to play their little transfer game. So I know United have got other options. They'll all be complicated as well, because the type of players they want, well, the clubs aren't really under any pressure to sell them. But I think the fundamentals are United do want him. Dortmund know they're going to have to sell him. If not this season, then the next season. And they know that when they buy British players, and I know this because I know people who dealt with them very, very closely, they're going to go back to playing in the Premier League, which is a far wealthier league. And really up how they do it. They pay good money for very young players. They give them a platform in front of 80,000, the highest average crowd in world football, and then they sell them on for a huge profit. I can't see why Sancho is going to be any different to that.
Andy, can I just ask you about the match day experience? You mentioned that you'd been to Cologne before with fans, experienced it last night, of course, without fans, and hopefully we have fans back at matches sometime in the near future. But there was a piece I was reading in your summer edition of United We Stand. I think it was Ian Sterling from the United Supporters Trust talking about this safe standing, and it's been a long-standing, forgive the pun, effort to get safe standing in Old Trafford. And he kind of gave a nice history of Hillsborough and the Taylor Report and the petitions that have been going around all these years to try and get safe standing back in the Premier League. And when you see games in Germany, they do match day experiences right. But for people who might not be fully up to date on that and the effort to get safe standing at Old Trafford, where is that currently at? Because, of course, there has been issues over maybe match day atmosphere at Old Trafford for quite some time.
There will be trials, and I think it's great that we're going to see standing back at Old Trafford, and cheers for buying the summer issue. We appreciate it. And Ian Sterling has been at the heart of negotiations to help bring this trial to Old Trafford. And we've got a lot of readers in Ireland, and it's a shame that Easons are not going to stock United We Stand anymore, because they've changed the terms and we just can't afford what they're asking for now because we're a small publisher. But we get loads of support from Ireland so that we can do in-depth pieces like this, because the match day culture is really important to our readers. Most of them are match-going United fans, so that puts them in a minority straight away. And Germany have done a lot of things right. Cheap admission prices, terracing, and for a decade I've been writing about how good the German fan culture is. And in 2017, FC Cologne played their first European game for 22 years at Arsenal, and 20,000 of them came to London, and 2,000 of them had tickets. And the English press were pretty quick to write them off as being hooligans, and they were not. I was in the middle of them. I know fan culture. I write about it. I travel around the world going to derbies. And I wrote a very complimentary article about FC Cologne fans, which got me offers of marriage from Cologne and Lucas Podolski writing to me. And I got to know Podolski. I went to see him. I'm going to see him this week. I went to see him in Japan. And he's like, you are the only person who understood our fan culture. And I took that as a great compliment, because I've been writing about fan culture since I've been 15. And it does matter. It's not just noise, background noise that you see on television. Football isn't just a sport that you watch through a screen. And live sport, and it doesn't just have to be football, it can be hurling, it can be rugby, is incredible, and it's really important. that sport plays a part in the community, big or small communities. And Manchester United are from Manchester. And for decades and over 100 years, people have gone to watch their local football club. And United now have gone way beyond that, and that's brilliant. And some of United's biggest fans are from nowhere near Manchester. I know people who are season ticket holders who come over from Ireland every game. I'm not going to embarrass them by naming them, but that's how well I know these people. You see them at games in Austria behind closed doors. People like Finno, who played top division football, actually, for Bray. He played in the final in 1990, I think, at Lansdowne Road. And he's a diehard Manchester United fan. I've got great respect for these people. But for too long, fans were being charged too much for tickets. I'm pleased that ticket prices have barely risen in a decade at Old Trafford. And the atmosphere suffered massively. And we documented it really well. Because at Old Trafford, it declined year after year from the late 80s. And seats didn't help. Ticket prices didn't help. And the bus I used to get from Urmston, quite close to Old Trafford, was packed when I was a teenager. And it's empty now. It's really sad that people on the doorstep felt that they couldn't no longer go to Old Trafford. And the demographic of the match-going fan became an ageing one. And there were so many frustrations there. And for decades, the club just shrugged it off. And I've since apologised. People like Martin Edwards have said to me, and he was the chairman, I got it wrong. I got it wrong putting an area of executive seating in the middle of the Stretford End. But now the club are listening to fans. The Red Army is a section in the Stretford End, vocal. That's boosted the atmosphere. The standing trial, I think, is a good thing. So finally, fans are being listened to. Germany have got a successful model for what the atmosphere should be like inside football stadiums. And these are encouraging.
John Finnegan played left wing in the 1990 FAI Cup final. Is that who you're talking about?
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
There you go. You just added him properly as a season ticket holder there. And they beat St. Francis that day. That was a plucky non-league team that they beat in the FAI Cup final. Couldn't happen anymore, Andy. It's exactly the type of fan culture that we're talking about. Great to have you with us. Stay safe and enjoy the rest of your time in Germany.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Always great to have Andy Mitten from United We Stand there. And I'm sure there are plenty of news agents around the world or around the country who might be interested in stepping in for Eason's to stock United We Stand.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.